No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace! Streets! Our streets! Our streets! This is what democracy looks like! This is what democracy looks like!
Out the house!
In the street!
Get out the house!
In the street!
I know that not everyone will be satisfied with the charges we've reported today. My team set out to investigate the circumstances surrounding Ms. Taylor's death. We did it with a singular goal in mind, pursuing the truth.
Protests erupted around the country last night in reaction to the long-awaited decision in the case of the killing of Breonna Taylor. That was Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron, who announced the grand jury results yesterday afternoon. During a botched raid of her apartment in March, Louisville police shot and killed Taylor, a 26-year-old emergency room technician. Former Detective Brett Hankison, one of the officers on the scene that night, was indicted with three counts of wanton endangerment for bullets fired into a neighboring apartment. The remaining officers involved in the raid, however, were not charged, and none of the officers were indicted for actions related to Taylor's death. The announcement provoked protests throughout the city of Louisville, where two police officers were also shot. And we asked you for your reactions.
Hi, my name is Kevin Gunn. I live in Louisville, Kentucky, and I am mortified. I'm outraged. It seems like our city and our state and the country values property more than they do about people, particularly black people.
My name's John. I'm calling from Elizabethtown, Kentucky. I think the decision made in the Breonna Taylor case, was, with the information currently available to the public and the media, the best decision that could be made.
This is Bronwyn Ramey in Louisville, Kentucky. I am sad and angry, and even worse, I'm not surprised. Backlash is so strong, I have a hard time hoping for anything to get better. My heart's breaking for our cities right now.
You can keep calling us to share your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Representative Sheila Jackson Lee from Texas weighed in on CNN yesterday, and she serves on the Judiciary Committee in the House.
It is shameful what came out of the Attorney General's office and the grand jury, not because of grand jurors, but because we know that prosecutors craft their own narrative. They can expand the number of witnesses that go into a grand jury, or it can be very narrow. It is very obvious to us that there was a grave injustice because did he call the other witnesses who said they did not hear the officers announce themselves?
Today on The Takeaway, we hear the public reaction to the Breonna Taylor grand jury. I'm Tanzina Vega. I'm joined by Graham Ambrose, reporter for the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting. Graham, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
And back with me is Tim Finley Jr., senior pastor at Kingdom Fellowship in Louisville and founder of the Justice and Freedom Coalition. Tim, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Tim, your reaction to the news last night?
Incredibly confused, disappointed, and shocked, honestly, that we, going into this situation, understood that there was a chance that there would be less charges. But I don't know if any of us really saw charges that were not even related to Breonna Taylor's murder. Still shocked, even hours later.
There were many emotional reactions to this. In addition to protests, people were visibly emotionally shaken by this news. Tim, how were the people that you work with in this space yesterday?
Well, I was at the square where many of the protests have happened. It's really been the central hub. And I was there actually when the announcement was given live. And I've never really seen anything like what I saw yesterday. It seemed as though it was trauma embodied. I would say it was a few minutes until it actually sunk in that not only were these indictments not connected to Breonna Taylor, but the fact that then a curfew was put in, it was disappointing, and people were literally just stunned.
Graham, part of the reaction that Tim is talking about here is largely because of the charges that were brought, or should we say not brought. Can you explain the charges that were brought against former Detective Brett Hankinson? What is wanton endangerment?
Wanton endangerment is not homicide. It involves basically, you know, a reckless disregard for human life. It's a felony here in Kentucky, punishable by up to 5 years. And in the indictment itself, it specifically says that the charges are related to Brett Hankinson firing his weapon into a nearby apartment that was not Breonna Taylor's and endangering the lives of three other people. And they list the initials of the three other people, and none of them are, you know, BT. None of them are Breonna Taylor.
Graham, I want to play a little bit more of Attorney General Cameron's press conference, because part of what was at issue here are something called no-knock warrants, which are warrants that allowed these officers to enter Taylor's home without her being aware that that was going to happen. Let's take a listen.
The officer's statements about their announcement are corroborated by an independent witness who was near in a proximity to apartment 4. In other words, the warrant was not served as a no-knock warrant.
Graham, what is Attorney General Cameron the point that he's trying to make there?
You know, the Attorney General is saying, yes, they did announce themselves. It sort of would lead to the use of force being more justified, right? If they announce themselves and still, you know, no one answered the door and someone ultimately fired from within the apartment, then, you know, of course they could return fire. However, this has been disputed by several neighbors at the apartment complex who said that, no, you know, the officers did not announce themselves. It's a pretty tight-knit community. I mean, the apartments are physically like right next to each other. It's in the middle of the night. And so, you know, these witnesses are saying, you know, hey, you know, we live there. We were there and we heard nothing until shots were fired.
Tim, when we know Attorney General Cameron was a featured person at the Republican National Convention. This is somebody who has the support, I would imagine, of President Trump and beyond. Tim, and he's also an African-American. How has the African-American community, the Black community more broadly, and even those who support the case for Breonna Taylor, how have they taken Cameron's approach?
To be completely blunt about it, anger. Daniel Cameron, I've had the opportunity several times to sit down and talk with him about this case. And again, I've always had an uneasy feeling just based off of where this country is, the climate, the inconsistencies in this case. I would say from the Black community, it feels as though Daniel Cameron never wanted to indict these officers. Listening to Lanita Baker and having an opportunity to talk with her, listening to Councilwoman Jessica Green, Sadiqua Reynolds, who is the Urban League president. All of these women are prosecutors or former prosecutors. And I've heard them all allude to in the last 24 hours this understanding in Louisville that a prosecutor here can indict a ham sandwich. And it just seems to me from hearing them that this is something that he never wanted to do. I think now this community will have a hard time trusting this attorney general. And that may not even be something that he's, you know, concerned about.
And Tim, when we spoke to you after the settlement Breonna Taylor's family received from the civil case, I'm wondering how the tone has changed now in light of this announcement by Cameron yesterday.
It just causes us to, number one, look at this criminal justice system and once again see that this system is not for Black people. But it has also brought us closer together. There are challenges. These days ahead are going to be difficult. But I really believe that this is going to produce a motivation for voting.
Graham, let's talk a little bit about the other officers that were involved here. Why were they not charged at all?
There were two other officers who have been really at the center of public attention. Brett Hankinson, the officer who was charged, was sort of known as the, by protesters as the worst offender. He was fired over the summer for his actions that night, which, you know, the chief of police at the time said were a shock to the conscience. But still, there were other officers involved in this raid. But the attorney general yesterday was saying that, you know, the grand jury was given all of the information. They were walked through all sorts of charges, and they ultimately decided not to make these charges.
This was a decision made by a grand jury. What options did the jury have in terms of the charges they could have levied against the officers, Graham?
They have a lot of freedom to make a charge based on whatever the evidence provides. Although in a lot of cases, I've spoken to a bunch of prosecutors here in Louisville, and they say that it's typical for a prosecutor to make a recommendation to the grand jury. And typically, grand juries will just follow these recommendations.
Tim, there were billboards. Oprah Winfrey bought a number of billboards to bring attention to this case. Magazine covers, including Vanity Fair, protests around the country, uprisings for racial justice in Breonna Taylor's name. And none of that yielded the indictments that people were hoping to see, or at the very least, the criminal charges that they were hoping to see. Tim, what are the implications for this for the future, essentially, of Black Kentuckians, at least when it comes to relations with police?
Obviously, this does not help. It's interesting being a Black American. It's interesting being someone in this country. When you talk to someone who isn't Black, it's almost hard for them to understand that even as a law-abiding citizen, when you are driving down the street and you see those blue lights, the kind of trepidation, the kind of anxiety that comes, even when it comes to the way that you are policed or questioned. You know, I've had moments where I was, you know, in my neighborhood growing up as a teenager and talked to in a way that I don't think that people talk to animals like that. And that was the culture in which many of us have grown up in. I believe that Breonna Taylor's name is going to be an absolute flashpoint from this point forward. When I think about my 19-year-old daughter, she doesn't have a necessary connection with, say, an Emmett Till. She knows from the history books. But when you talk about Breonna Taylor, that's going to be her generation's Emmett Till. It's going to be a flashpoint. And my prayer is that it would be motivation for all of us to put pressure on this system to not just reform policing, but we have to reimagine policing. Because as it is right now, as it stands right now, this is a major issue, you know, all the way from the way that we're policed to the criminal justice system and incarceration and the numbers who are incarcerated, Black men, Black women. So this moment, I think it is extremely important that either we're going to take this moment and there's going to be change, or we're going to continue down a road that is going to further divide this country. And that is, I think this puts so much pressure on us for November, because who's in that Oval Office will also have an indelible mark in this moment.
Graham, where does the criminal case go from here? Is this the end of it? Is the Department of Justice investigating any other charges in this case, including the civil rights charges?
This is likely the close to one arm of the investigative process. So this basically closes the state investigation into that raid. But there's a federal investigation ongoing. It's from the FBI, and it'll be reviewed by the U.S. Department of Justice. And they're looking at whether or not civil rights were violated, at least according to the Kentucky Attorney General at his press conference yesterday. So, you know, it's likely that there will be no more state charges brought in this case, but it is possible that there will be federal charges if the investigation turns something up.
Tim, what about for racial justice advocates?
Well, the only thing that we really can do is continue fighting, obviously in this fight for justice, but we turn our attention to, and I shouldn't say turn our attention to because it's been there the whole time, but we really begin to focus on elected officials. You know, that to me is the next step. Everyone from our mayor, from our Metro Council here, and even to the individuals that they appoint, we have to have people in positions that have the community that I'm a part of, our best interests at heart. And it's disheartening because many of us want justice now, But we have to understand that this is the long game. And that is our next step. That's our next strategy. And as advocates, as activists, as organizers, it is our goal to rally, to get people registered to vote, and to really take an interest in those individuals that have influence and yet do not use that influence for our community. And that's why I'm focusing in on our mayor, who I believe needs to step down, our Metro Council members who voted to increase the LMPD budget in the middle of protesting police brutality, and everyone else who had a hand in, even the judges, the judge who signed this search warrant. All of these individuals who have been appointed, who have been elected into these positions, the Black community has to show that we're together and that we will no longer sit by and allow people who come to our churches, come into our community, put their signs up, and then disappear when we need them most. We have to show that that is no longer acceptable.
Tim Findlay Jr. is a senior pastor at Kingdom Fellowship in Louisville and the founder of the Justice and Freedom Coalition. And Graham Ambrose is a reporter for the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting. Graham, Tim, thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
On Saturday, President Trump is expected to announce his nomination to replace Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And while rushing through a Supreme Court confirmation just weeks ahead of a presidential election is a very divisive move, it appears that Senate Republicans have the votes necessary to confirm the president's pick. Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Susan Collins of Maine are the only Republican senators who have come out against confirming a new justice prior to the election. And that leaves Senate Democrats without many options in the weeks ahead. To get a better sense of how those senators on the left are thinking about a fight to replace Justice Ginsburg, I got Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey on the line. And Senator Booker is also a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Well, I think that we need to all speak with a voice, those of us who believe that there is something deeply wrong with them proceeding. When Merrick Garland was proposed by Barack Obama with about 260 plus days left in before an election, the Republicans made a passionate argument citing precedent, the moral issues of letting the electorate decide, and really set a rule. And here we are some 4 years later, and they're contradicting not just what they said then, but many of them spoke to this issue, including Lindsey Graham, spoke to this issue just months ago and said that if a vacancy opened up in an election year, that we should not move forward. And so, again, this is something that they look like they're going to do everything they can to move forward on. But I don't think we should stop in calling out the hypocrisy of this. And given the last wishes of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who I don't think she knew the outcome of the election, but I think she must have been thinking about the very legitimacy of the court, not to have it so undermined by what seems like a raw political power grab at a time that many of our institutions are losing their legitimacy because of politics, whether it's what Donald Trump has done with the CDC, the post office, the very presidency itself, to allow the Supreme Court to further lose its legitimacy in the eyes of the American public is a dangerous, dangerous thing. So I'm not sure how this is going to proceed exactly. I think that Mitch McConnell has extraordinary power to push this through, but I will not be silent in what I think is a damage, not just to the legitimacy of the institution of the Supreme Court, but to major issues like a healthcare case for the Affordable Care Act that is racing to the Supreme Court now. This is going to affect Americans' lives and their ability to access healthcare in deep ways. And I just really believe this is a time that we should see the restraint of power as opposed to what we're seeing right now.
Senator Booker, historically, at least over the past couple of decades, conservatives and Republicans have made the Supreme Court a key issue. They have vetted nominees with the Federalist Society. They have made this a key part of galvanizing their base. Democrats, on the other hand, have not been as aggressive with making the Supreme Court an issue at the polls in terms of galvanizing their base. Has that inaction or lack of aggressiveness, if you will, led us to where we are today? And what can the Democrats do better?
Well, I think that a lot of people on various issues are seeing just how powerful the Supreme Court is in affecting their daily lives, whether it is the recent decisions on the ability for labor to organize. We have seen this Supreme Court begin to undermine unions, whether it's decisions on voting rights, the gutting of the Voting Rights Act, undermining people's decisions, ability to access the polls, whether it's even the freedom and equality of LGBTQ Americans on how narrow majorities were able to secure basic fundamental rights, but there are still rights and freedoms at stake. There's so much in the balance. And as I said before, perhaps the most immediate one is that all the Americans with pre-existing conditions or who have benefited, the millions who've benefited from Medicaid expansion and more, the millions of Americans who have seen a benefit of the Affordable Care Act now know that a president who has pledged to tear down the Affordable Care Act, this will be before a new Supreme Court. So I think this is animating people, where people are realizing a lot of their fundamental rights, economic security, and equality are at stake here. And I think it's going to be a motivating issue in this election. And I will remind people that there is nothing that the Republicans can do in the waning days, I hope, of the Trump administration that cannot be corrected if we control the White House again with Joe Biden, and if Democrats get the majority in the United States Senate. We have a lot of options then about how to balance the scales of justice and to undo a lot of the damage that this administration has done.
Senator, some of that correcting, if you will, at least one option in correcting, has been to pack the court. California Senator Dianne Feinstein, the top Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, appears to be against the idea of expanding the Supreme Court. But there are other Democrats like Senator Ed Markey who have explicitly called for packing the court to balance its ideological tilt, specifically, especially if the Ginsburg seat is replaced. Where do you come down on that solution, Senator?
Well, I am going to be a very loud voice and reminding people that this debate is mute. It's mute if we do not win back the Senate and the White House. And as opposed to using my energy to engage in hypothetical debates, why don't we engage in winning first and then have that conversation, have a national conversation, not just about that, but the filibuster, everything. Let's have that debate after an election, because if we fail to get the majority of the Senate, and that is right on a razor's edge right now. If we fail to get the majority, Mitch McConnell is still in power, and we have seen the kind of power he can wield in the Senate under a Democratic president and under a Republican president. So as opposed to wasting our energy over hypothetical debates, let's win first and then have a constructive conversation about how to make our democracy more democratic.
Speaking of some of those Senate races we are seeing right now, following the death of Justice Ginsburg, a significant amount of money is coming into some of these candidates right now. Are you optimistic, Senator Booker, that the Senate will, in fact, be flipped again towards the Democrats?
You know, I was taught by some great folks in the Central Ward of Newark, New Jersey, that, you know, optimism, sort of a sunshiny view, is not what we need. What we need is work. What we need is struggle. So I'm not leaving anything to chance. Many people were optimistic about Secretary Clinton's victory 4 years ago. This is a time to get to work. And there's a lot of fear, but people need to turn their fear into fight. They're agonizing into organizing, and their worry into work. That's what this moment calls for. I know, as my tenant president, when I used to live in some high-rise projects, brick towers, she taught me that hope is the active conviction that despair will not have the last word. So right now, the moment calls for investing your time, your energy, and resources into this election. If you want to take back the Senate, don't talk about it, be about it, and contribute, help, organize, send a contribution to some of those important Senate races that are in the balance right now.
Senator, you mentioned living in public housing. I, too, spent the first 20-some-odd years of my life in public housing in New York City. I'm very familiar with some of the issues that come up in poor communities of color, particularly when they're Black and brown. And one of those is police reform. Since the killing of George Floyd and the killing of Breonna Taylor, you have also called for significant reforms to police departments. There have been even broader calls to, quote-unquote, defund police departments. Senator, where do you stand on some of those reforms, and is defunding the police the solution?
Well, first and foremost, I, with Kamala Harris in the Senate, authored a piece of legislation with, in partnership with Congressional Black Caucus members, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Nadler, in the House, to do massive reforms. Now, I call them massive reforms, but they are wildly popular with Democrats and Republicans. In fact, many of the reforms in our legislation were adopted and passed from Iowa to Colorado by Republican legislatures. And so let's just start with the basics. In the United States of America, there should not be chokeholds. In the United States of America, there should not be, in these drug cases, no-knock warrants that led to the death of Breonna Taylor. In the United States of America, our public institutions should be far more accountable. Policing should be far more transparent, and police departments should have to report out their data on the kind of stops they make, and are they racially biased, on their uses of force. And in the United States of America, if a police officer does something that is criminal, they should be held accountable, and we should get rid of qualified immunity and make the standard for the use of force one that is more reasonable, not as high that it's very hard to get a federal conviction against a police officer who has done something horribly wrong. And so what I'm pushing right now, and I think that will pass if it's not for Mitch McConnell, who I'm not using any a pejorative here. He calls himself the Grim Reaper, as he has killed bipartisan bill after bipartisan bill. If we want to get the beginnings of real police reform done, Mitch McConnell cannot be there, or else it will not happen. It will not pass. Now, as a guy who actually has spent the last 20 plus years working in a majority Black city, working in a city that has struggled since the riots of the 60s that started with issues of police brutality that were written about in reports from the Kerner Report to even when the Justice Department came to Newark and showed the biases in our stops. I know there has to be major investments in our country in the things that reduce the need for police in the first place. The fact that we are a nation that treats mental health and addiction not with health care and treatment, but with prison and jail, shows how backwards we are, that we would rather spend much more money on the back end of a problem than investing in human flourishing and human well-being. Even police and law enforcement agencies that I dealt with, including the FBI, in my first meeting with them, when I asked them, how do we solve the problems? And we were talking about gang violence. And they looked at me, and very honestly, the head of the FBI in the state of New Jersey said, we don't solve these problems. In other words, he knew that they just dealt with the symptoms of the failures of our society to invest in our children, to invest in child well-being, to invest in education and healthcare. We are a society that spends more on locking up its own people than any other country in the nation. The land of the free is the mass incarceration capital of the globe. It is absolutely, morally, abjectly bankrupt what we do as a society through law enforcement. It is time that this country begins to prioritize investing in human well-being and human flourishing, where for our investments in those things, we will reap a massive return, not just in economic terms. Our economy would thrive, but really in what we are a nation that says we're dedicated to, which is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Senator, on this show, when I took over as host of the show, I basically isolated three gaps in American society that I thought would essentially root this show. And one of them is the truth gap. Another one is the empathy gap. And the third is the racial wealth gap. Part of closing that gap, as you mentioned, the economics of our communities is a big part of, I think, where we would begin to see some of the changes that you're describing. Senator, in 2018, you introduced legislation that would create so-called baby bonds, which are interest-bearing funds for every newborn in the country. Your proposal hasn't been taken up for a vote, but Governor Phil Murphy seems to support a similar plan. Senator, why are baby bonds an important part, in your estimation, of addressing the racial wealth gap?
Well, it is clear in this country that we have, as you've reported, a massive wealth gap. For every dollar that the average white family has, the average black family has about 10 cents. For every dollar that the average white family has, the average Latino family has about 12 cents. And this is something that hurts our overall economy, and that racial wealth gap is real, and it undermines the success of our society. I believe that we already use our tax code to help wealthy people get more wealth. These tax expenditures are upwards of $650 billion a year. And I support some of these things, like the mortgage interest deduction, which helps people. It's overwhelmingly used by people who make $250,000 or more. And it is a tax expenditure. It's time that we use our tax code to help people without wealth gain wealth, because paychecks help you get by, wealth helps you get ahead, and can be generational. And so our plan is very simple. If every child born in America, black or white, or regardless of background, gets a $1,000 savings account, social scientists show that that alone will actually increase the numbers of kids' a chance of going to college threefold, just knowing they have an account like that. And then every year, based upon their family's income, nothing to do with race, but just on their family's income, like the earned income tax credit, they will get anywhere between $0 and $2,000 placed in their account. And because of compounding interest, the lowest income children, in other words, we're a nation with one out of every six of our children born in and living in poverty, those kids would have upwards of $50,000 by the time they're 18. And that money then, with a baby bonds proposal, could be used to invest in wealth-producing investments, college education, buying a home, starting a business. Now, Columbia University and others have looked at it. It would actually have the effect of closing the racial wealth gap for those young people starting out, a new generation of Americans starting out with the racial wealth gap closed. And whether you are, and I've talked to Joe Manchin about this in West Virginia, a poor white family living in Appalachia, or a family in the Central Ward of Newark where I live, those children would start out with wealth and the ability to invest in things that ultimately have allowed other families to pass things down through generations, and ultimately actually would inure to the benefit of society as a whole by creating more wealth in our society. And these are the kind of proposals that we don't just need. I think there is a moral urgency to do something like this. You mentioned in your trifecta of things that you wanted to focus on in the show, I believe the most important of those three is addressing the poverty of empathy in this country. We are a nation that is an outlier in terms of other wealthy nations on the planet, in terms of what we do for children. We are an outlier, the only industrial nation that doesn't have paid family leave, the only industrial nation that doesn't have universal prenatal care, the industrial nation that leads in infant mortality, that leads in maternal mortality, that leads in low birth weight babies, that doesn't have universal preschool. I mean, all of these things that we deny children what they need to flourish, what every economist who does the studies have shown, investments in these things produce a greater return. And why? Is it because we don't love our children? No, we do. But we do not understand the struggles of a good number of American children. And that poverty of empathy, if we can ignite that most basic human instinct to care for each other, our policies will, and hopefully sooner than later, start to reflect the love that we have in this nation. But right now, they don't. Right now, they're Byzantine. We do things in this country to our children that other nations actually call torture, like putting children in solitary confinement in prison for months, even years, who haven't even been convicted of anything yet because they can't get out because they can't afford bail. These are the kind of things that we do, poisoning our children. And when I say that, I mean that very literally. There are over 3,000 jurisdictions in America where children have more than twice the blood lead levels of Flint, Michigan, because we haven't prioritized the infrastructure dollars necessary to get rid of all the lead service lines in our country, which is actually not that expensive of an endeavor. We have to, in this country, begin to prioritize children and low-income children especially. That is a test of our love for one another. And right now, we are failing that test.
Senator, before we go, I have to ask, given the landscape that you just painted of this country, the global pandemic, the increasing wealth gap, you mentioned a lot of things that we need to do to get back on track. And two of your colleagues, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, are hoping to win the presidency and the vice presidency, respectively. Senator, they're not as visible out on the campaign trail as President Trump is. So how is it that they can reconnect with voters looking for solutions to some of the issues that you just outlined?
So I'm blessed in a way that I have to sort of pinch myself every day to be a United States senator. As my mom has told me all the time, don't forget what it took for me to become the fourth elected African-American senator in the history of our nation. And I am blessed to have relationships with people like Kamala Harris, who is now not just a colleague, she's really like a friend and a sister, and to have run for president and got a deeper relationship with Joe Biden. Their campaigns are staying focused on these issues. And I know people believe this pandemic is in many ways keeping candidates off the campaign trail. But I just keep returning to the simple truth of this moment we're in, which is this election is not a referendum on any one person or one office. It is a referendum on who we are as a nation and who we are going to be to each other. This is a moral moment in America. It's not about left or right. It's will we go forward or will we languish where we are right now, which is really in the valley of the shadow of death. And so my hope is that Americans will take it upon themselves to learn more about the candidates, to learn more about their vision. And if they do believe that this is the most important election of our lifetime, that we will all begin to act like it. This is not a moment where we're called to do freedom rides, knowing that our buses will be bombed, or to do marches like John Lewis, knowing that we'll get beaten and have to bleed the earth red for freedom and justice. No, this is a moment where we just have to participate and engage in an election that will determine everything from the health care we have and the cost of our prescription drugs to whether we continue to be a nation of mass incarceration. This is what's at hand. And so this is a time, if ever in our lives, we should be pouring our time, our energy, and even our money into making sure that the right outcome happens in this election. Because this is not their test, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. This is our test. And dear God, for the sake of not just our nation, but with climate change, for the sake of humanity, I hope that America passes this test.
Senator Cory Booker is the junior senator from New Jersey, and he serves on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Senator Booker, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
We want you to be part of the Takeaways Listener Response Network. We'll send you a few text messages a week about topics we're discussing on our show. To sign up, just text the word START to 69866. Standard data and messaging rates apply, and you can always text the word STOP to opt out. Again, text START to 69866 to join our conversation every day. You can also connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, we're at The Takeaway.
It's been 6 months since the coronavirus pandemic caused school systems across the country to shut their doors and scramble to adapt to remote learning. And though the challenges posed by COVID-19 remain as acute as ever, we're now getting a better sense of how public high schools fared in the transition to this new reality. In a report released today, the UCLA Institute for Democracy, Education, and Access found that 92% of schools had to provide meals to students during the pandemic, 93% supplied technology like tablets and laptops, and 43% provided support for students whose loved ones passed away. For more on the survey's findings and what they say about our education system, I'm bringing in John Rogers, one of the report's authors, and he's also a professor of education at UCLA and faculty director at the university's Center X. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tanzina. I'm very happy to be here.
So you surveyed hundreds of high school principals, and that some of those results were pretty stunning. How is it that principals were responding to providing meals, providing technology, providing emotional support? Was that coming all from them?
It came from them and then their staff as well. I think one of the things that we see is that as the pandemic emerged, schools responded in very proactive ways to try to meet the extraordinary needs that were playing out. So schools, as you suggested, provided meals. They provided mental health counseling. They connected students to healthcare. They were the cornerstone of their communities, sustaining their communities through a very difficult time.
And one of the things that's interesting and we can't lose sight of is that students often, low-income students in particular, are also provided meals at school. John, has that become more of an acute need during the pandemic?
Absolutely. Many of the principals talked about emerging hunger that was playing out not just for the students, but the students' families. And a number of principals reported that they not only were providing meals to their students, but to their students' siblings and other members of their students' families. And they were doing this in very complicated ways because students could no longer receive the meals in the school cafeteria. Schools sometimes provided them in locations in the community, sometimes even sending the meals out directly to the students' homes.
One of the other things that's been exacerbated by this pandemic across the country is the access to the technology that's needed for remote learning, which was interesting that you found that a lot of principals were actually helping with that as well. Remote learning has really exacerbated that inequality, John. Is that right?
It certainly has. We've had a digital divide for some time. But during remote learning, we saw that high poverty schools were much less ready to jump in and enable all of their students to participate on the first day. And that was not just because many students lacked either the devices or the connectivity. It was also because some teachers and other key staff at schools didn't have those either devices or connectivity on the first day. And so high poverty schools were far less likely than schools in more affluent communities to be ready early on. And then even after schools ramped up, it was the case that high poverty schools were more likely to have many students who lacked either a laptop or a tablet or some sort of connectivity that allowed them to participate fully in the remote learning environment.
And some of the principals that you spoke to had, or that were part of the study, had to really come up with some creative solutions. Let's listen to how one principal responded to what was happening.
My name is Dr. Cynthia Gonzalez. I'm a high school principal in South Central Los Angeles. And one of the innovative things we did was to buy Facebook ads to push out to our community. Often our families don't have working phone numbers or are continuously moving. And so this was one way to reach them and to make sure that they stayed in communication with us to get updates about student information and community resources.
John, I would never have assumed a Facebook ad could be used that effectively. What were the other ways that principals were making use of some creative solutions?
Well, principals tried to reach out to students in a variety of different ways. Some were fairly traditional: phone calls, emails, text messages. Principals also, half of our principals reported that they did home visits. They or their staff did home visits in order to connect with students who otherwise were not participating fully. I should note that there was a real divide in this, that again, students in high poverty schools were far more likely to either not be participating regularly or to be out of contact entirely. And this was because students in high poverty schools were far more likely to be experiencing a set of challenges that were created by the pandemic, challenges that related to economic insecurity, challenges that called for young people in high poverty schools to be essential workers themselves or to care for siblings who were not being supervised because they themselves were out of school. And so we saw that those principals in high poverty schools were far more likely to have to take these steps to connect with students.
John, what about the emotional support that principals were providing for students who like that, who may have been stressed because of the exacerbated issues because of the pandemic, because they may have lost someone? Tell us a little bit about that role.
Yes, many principals spoke to us about the trauma that was unfolding in their schools as students were experiencing death in their families, death in the broader community, and or sickness that was playing out. Many schools provided mental health support to their students. They tried to create a sense of community and support. Of course, this was particularly challenging in an environment where they couldn't connect with the students through traditional means, and they had to do this virtually. And so fostering that sense of support and community through Zoom or other virtual means was a challenge, but schools tried their best to meet that need.
So, John, one of the things that comes up quite a bit when we're talking about schools, right, especially right now, is just how much teachers in particular are spending their own money to create environments that are safe for students to come back, especially when it comes to in-person learning. At the same time, budgets are being sliced across the country. Are principals, and even more broadly, teachers, really prepared for these budgetary shortfalls right now? I mean, given everything that we just talked about?
I think one of the challenges we face is that there's budgetary shortfalls this year. Next year's budgets promise to be even more challenging. And unless there is an infusion of federal funds into state budgets, the state budgets, which are being pressed by lower tax revenues, are going to be really hard hit. And so schools that are being asked to do more than ever are going to have far less resources to fill those needs.
How are educators reckoning with comments from local officials that contradict what they're trying to teach students about the reality of this pandemic?
We heard from a few principals that the broader political environment was creating an atmosphere that made it harder to fulfill their roles. One principal in Utah told us that he felt pulled apart by political division and a lack of social trust. Another principal in Arizona told us that she had to sit by and watch as members of her community went to the local bar to watch a virtual graduation because the school had to follow the CDC guidelines, but the community did not. And that speaks to the ways in which not having clear health guidelines that are provided across the community create a sense of uncertainty and division that make it difficult for principals to support their schools and to support their community. It leads to communities in which some people feel like they should be wearing masks and some shouldn't. And principals who need to foster a sense of commonality where everybody's working together, it's far more difficult when there's that sense of social division.
And finally, what about students who were English language learners? They were hit particularly hard by this pandemic, weren't they?
They were. We did ask principals if they were able to provide English learners with materials in their home language. Some did, but many did not. And so we see that many English learners were not able to access instruction in a language that they understood. I think more profoundly, English learners did not have access to the sorts of informal exchanges that they would oftentimes have in a regular classroom with other students that would develop their linguistic capacities. And so I think many districts are recognizing that the very first students that need to be provided with in-person instruction should be English learners alongside of students with special needs.
There's so much there that educators are trying to make up for in this very difficult time. John Rogers is a professor of education at UCLA and the faculty director at the University Center X. John, thanks for coming on The Takeaway.
Thank you so much, Tanzina.
Tributes to Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg have flooded the news and social media since she died last Friday. But one of the most powerful of these tributes came from NPR's Nina Totenberg, who covered Justice Ginsburg and the U.S. Supreme Court for decades. Totenberg's obit didn't just reflect on the life and legacy of Justice Ginsburg, but also on her personal relationship with the cultural and political icon. The two had been close friends for 50 years, with the late Justice even presiding over Totenberg's second wedding.
I sometimes was asked how I could remain such good friends with RBG at the same time that I covered her as a reporter. The answer was really pretty simple. If you're lucky enough to be friends with someone like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, starting when both of you are young, you understand that each of you has a job, and it has to be done professionally and without favor.
But as a journalist and close friend, can you really cover a public figure like a Supreme Court justice without favor? And is there an inherent conflict of interest in that relationship and others that come up in journalism? So for that and more, we're now going to talk to Washington Post media reporter Paul Fahey about all of this. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Tanzina.
Well, Nina says it's pretty simple to be able to have a friendship with someone like Ruth Bader Ginsburg and cover her at the same time. I don't think so. What do you think?
I don't think so at all. It raises all kinds of questions. When you are a young reporter, it is beaten into you that your relationships are very important and your distance from those relationships are important. You have to maintain an arm's length relationship with the people you cover to create objectivity, neutrality, and balance. When you become friends with the people you are covering, it taints that relationship, and it raises a question. Once people know that you are having this kind of relationship, are you pulling your punches? Is your reporting in some way affected by the relationship? We wouldn't accept a reporter covering their spouse or their business partner or, you know, their romantic interest. We don't really accept it in terms of reporters covering their friends.
Has Totenberg or NPR responded to any of the criticism of her friendship with Justice Ginsburg?
Yes. Nina Totenberg was very upfront about it. I contacted her the other day, and almost instantly she said, give me a call, and we spoke for about 45 minutes about it. She's addressed it before, and the clip you played, that was more or less her answer to me, too. NPR's response was a little bit different and kind of funny in a way. They basically said they've known each other for a very long time. This is a relationship that goes back to the 1970s. Our handbook of ethics says you can't have a source influence your story. And they left it at that, which frankly doesn't really address the issue. They have previously policed these kinds of relationships. A couple of hosts were taken off being hosts while their spouses were working for the Obama administration. NPR thought that was a conflict. But Nina Totenberg occupies kind of a special place, a rarefied place at NPR. She's very popular among listeners. She's a very good reporter. And she's been there since 1975, covering the same beat. So she gets special dispensation for this sort of conflict. Now, the real issue in some ways is maybe you can finesse this by disclosing it so there's no hidden agendas, nothing held back from listeners. If Nina Totenberg simply said every time she covered the court, I'm friends, I've had a long relationship with RBG, you should know about this as part of her reporting, in some ways that might make it less an issue, but she very, very rarely did that. This issue has come up from time to time, but, you know, Nina Totenberg did hundreds and hundreds of stories, has done hundreds and hundreds of stories about the court, and she rarely ever disclosed it on the air.
There's a lot in that answer that I want to unpack here, because I feel like there's a difference in terms of fairness, in terms of how some reporters are treated versus others who have these relationships. And granted, there are not all of the reporters that are out there, but there is some sort of a special treatment here being afforded to Totenberg for her, as you mentioned, many, many decades of reporting. I'm wondering a couple things. First of all, NPR obviously benefits from this relationship in some ways. It's part of I guess, in a larger context, what's called access journalism, right? Mm-hmm. So news organizations do benefit from these high-level relationships. Isn't that right, Paul?
Yes, and listeners do too, I might add. Nina Totenberg, in talking with me, said, my job is to know these people as well as I can and to know everything about them. And that's true for any reporter. And so in knowing them so intimately, it informs her reporting. It allows her to be able to have some insights that a reporter who doesn't have this kind of relationship might not have. So there is a benefit to it. But, you know, the question is at what price and at what cost to have that benefit.
I also want to point out here that there, in terms of talking about objectivity, and I think it would be, for example, in the case of Totenberg and Justice Ginsburg, NPR could say, well, you can cover the court, you just can't cover Justice Ginsburg specifically, right? And we see a lot of those accommodations or requests, I should say, being made by news organizations, as you mentioned. If I'm covering, if I'm a business reporter, for example, I have to disclose to my news organization if I have certain investments in certain companies that would preclude me from covering those companies fairly, for example. And so this is a pretty standard request from news outlets. And I just want to broaden the lens here, because oftentimes when we talk about objectivity, we hear from journalists of color, LGBTQ+ journalists, about how they've often been reprimanded because they can't, quote, be objective covering issues relating to their own communities. It feels like that's a double standard, Paul.
Well, that's a can of worms.
Just a small one.
Yes. Ever since I've been a reporter, and it's been a long time, we've tried to diversify our newsrooms that I've worked in. And the reason for that is we want multiple perspectives. We want people from different backgrounds to be able to present the world to our readers because they have experience in what they're reporting on. But that's not exactly the same as we want you to favor the group that you make emanate from, the group that you are part of. We want you to bring insight to your coverage based on your experience, but we don't want you to tilt the coverage, you know, to favor that group. And it's a very fine line, I admit, and it's one that could tilt the wrong way. You know, we as reporters are obligated to being fair and neutral. And we get into arguments all the time, as do readers with us, about how you define those things. But I don't think background per se is prejudicial. In fact, I think it's beneficial. But, you know, we all need to check our prejudices. We all need to check our biases and account for them. And as a professional reporter, you know, you're not doing your job unless you do those things constantly.
Paul Fahre is the Washington Post's media reporter. Paul, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Tanzina.
All right, everybody, that's our show for today, and that's it for me this week. Amy Walter is in tomorrow, and I'll be back on Monday. And I want to give a shout out to the amazing team that makes this show every day. Lee Hill is our executive producer, David Gable is our executive assistant, Polly Arungu and Dina Syed Ahmed are our digital editors, Alexandra Boti is our senior producer, and her production team is Ethan Oberman, Jose Olivares, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, and Lydia McMullen-Laird. Jackie Martin and Jay Cowett were our line producers this week, and a big thanks to our board operator, Debbie Daughtry, and our sound designer and director, Vince Fairchild. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.